A dam holding back billions of gallons of water fails and hundreds of lives are lost in the deluge that follows in California. No, it's not a hypothetical what-if scenario for Oroville Dam. It really happened in Southern California in 1928. Find out the lessons learned and the lingering questions about the deadliest man-made disaster of the 20th century. It's all new and all blue except for the scary muddy brown part. Next. Nolan, you've had to deal with the recent evacuation of thousands of people below Oroville Dam's damaged spillways. What's that been like for you here at the station?
It's been exciting and educational, actually. You know, similar to how a lot of the officials have been reacting to something that hasn't happened before. You know, we've kind of had the same experience here at the station. And partnering with KQED and Capital Public Radio, learning from them, it's been awesome.
Yeah, and you guys had really, you know, all hands on deck around here, you know, getting all that information out, which is so important to people because it's a pretty scary thing to go through to have to leave your home. Well, let's find out about what happened in March of 1928 in Southern California. John Wilkman is a filmmaker, perhaps best known for his television series Moguls and Movie Stars, A History of Hollywood. His 2016 book, Flood Path, is an in-depth look at the disastrous failure of the St. Francis Dam just north of Los Angeles. He joins us via Skype. John, welcome.
What a pleasure, Dave, to talk to you about, I hate to say it, my favorite dam.
Well, disasters are interesting, and this one's especially interesting. But before we get going, let's geographically orient everyone. Where exactly is San Francisquito Canyon, and where was the St. Francis Dam?
San Francisquito Canyon is about 50 miles from downtown Los Angeles, the old downtown Los Angeles. And I would say probably from the 5 freeway, which runs north, it's about 12 or 15 miles into San Francisquito Canyon that runs northeast from where the 5 freeway is now.
And the Owens Aqueduct actually goes through there, right?
Yeah, actually, it's part of the Owens Aqueduct. The dam was constructed as part, it's part of the aqueduct system, and which goes through San Francisquito Canyon and then hits its first reservoirs, the Van Norman reservoirs, which are in the northern San Fernando Valley.
Well, what led to your interest in this story? Because, you know, you decided to write a book about it. And from talking to friends and people, this is a relatively little known chapter of California history, but it seems like it should be more well known. Why is it so little known? And why did you get interested in it?
Well, I grew up in Los Angeles, and like many kids who grew up in Los Angeles who are interested in history and the arts and things like that, of course, why would you stay in Los Angeles? There's no history here, and the only arts are really not arts, it's the movies. So you've got to go east. So that's where it's all happening. So I actually went to a college in the Midwest and then continued headed east to New York, where I started my career there working as a researcher for CBS News documentary unit, which was a series called The 20th Century, which was hosted by Walter Cronkite. And that's how I started my career. So when I worked there in New York for about 15 years, I decided for some strange reason to come back to Los Angeles. And when I came back, I was astonished to find, gee, this city does have a history. It's fascinating and very important. And in my research to find out more about my city, I ran across a book by a man named Charles Outland, who wrote a book in 1963 about this disaster, the St. Francis Dam disaster. It wasn't a widely known book. And I read this and I said, my God, this is an incredible story. How come nobody knows about it? And my wife, Nancy, who was my partner at the time, my late wife, who was my partner at the time, she read the book as well and decided we need to find a way to tell this story. So the first thing we did was to, this was in the early 1990s, begin to search out survivors and eyewitnesses and to videotape their stories. And so we decided to really get as many of those, because they were getting into their 70s, 80s, and 90s, many of them, and to get their stories down on videotape. And other projects came and went in between. And Nancy passed away about 4.5 years ago. And when she died, I had this enormous amount of research, and I said to myself, let's get this thing done. Let's write this book, because even then, it was still a totally unknown story. And it just wasn't, you know, a terrible disaster. It was the second worst disaster of any kind in California after the San Francisco earthquake. But if it's as a man-made disaster, this was not an earthquake. This was actually a man-made failure. It is the worst in the 20th century in the United States. And why this is not known, of course, intrigued me. And that's what got me involved.
And do we know approximately how many people perished in the flood after the dam failed?
Well, the number is uncertain, mainly because it was an isolated area. There were some transients who were coming through, and also many migrant workers or Mexican-American workers. The counted bodies found, identified, and unidentified as about 600, about 460 or something, a little less than 500. That's the best count that we can come up with. But many think that it could be more. But as far as actually confirmed deaths and victims, that's what we have.
Well, your book really is also the story of the dam's builder, the legendary chief engineer for the L.A. Department of Water and Power, William Mulholland, famous for Mulholland Drive and the Mulholland Highway. Give us, as quick as you can, an overview of his life leading up to the building of the dam.
Actually, there would be no Los Angeles as we know it today without William Mulholland. He came here in 1877 in his early 20s. He was a seaman and had been roaming of the sea, had left his home in Ireland when he was a young man, 15 years old, and arrived in Los Angeles in 1877 and found a job as a ditch digger, basically clearing the way for the canals called the Zanja Madre, which was the early Mexican-era water system that still supplied Los Angeles in the 1870s. And he, on his own, read about hydraulic engineering and became a self-taught engineer. So when the city of Los Angeles acquired the water system from the previous private owners, 48-year-old William Mulholland, who was known and respected by this time, was put in charge. And very quickly after that, the city had already had these enormous booms, and the 1880s was the first one. And people realized this Los Angeles River, which is basically a desert river, it sort of comes and goes with the seasons, was not going to be enough to support a big city. And so Mulholland joined with a couple of other guys, former Fred Eaton, who was a former city engineer and a mayor, and J.B. Lippincott, who was another engineer. And Eaton had an idea that they could build an aqueduct and carry the water from the Sierra watershed 233 miles away, downhill all the way with no pumps, to Los Angeles. And William Mulholland was given the job to make this thing happen. And he did. And it brought a river to this town of Los Angeles. And without that river of water, there would be no modern Los Angeles. Mulholland's a remarkable man, great in his achievements and great in his failings.
And we're talking about the Owens Valley is where they brought that water.
This is where the water came from the watershed of the Owens Valley. And when the story we all know from Chinatown has an element of truth in it. It was done surreptitiously in the sense that the water wasn't stolen. That's the word, oh, they stole our water. No, it was paid for. And most of the early acquisitions of land and water rights were in land that was, you know, alkaline. It wasn't particularly valuable. And they were paying, you know, good prices for it. And so the people of the Owens Valley who were selling thought these city slickers don't know what they're doing. My God, they're paying for this land. So they were pleased with their profits. And when they found out later that this was going to be, in fact, the rights for the river at that point were going to be used for an aqueduct to Los Angeles, of course, they were very angry. They figured they'd been snookered, and they had been. But they were paid. The water wasn't stolen. It was paid for. And also, in order to do that, you have to get back in the period of the time, which is, you know, in the early 1900s. The president was Theodore Roosevelt, who was an early progressive. And Roosevelt's philosophy and the progressive philosophy at that time was resources should be given the greatest good to the greatest number. So the idea was, you know, 300 or 400 ranchers shouldn't control enough water for 100,000 city people. And that was the progressive thought of the day. So Theodore Roosevelt supported the city in getting their water and allowed them to use federal land as they were planning it. So it's hard when you look at it now, and we have the environmental movement, we have, of course, Los Angeles emerging, we have all kinds of other things, to understand what the political environment was at that time. And that's what I try to do in the book.
Lead us through the events of March 12th, 1928. You start your story with Mulholland and his assistant, Harvey Van Norman. They visit the dam site because there's a leak.
Yeah. The dam, as most concrete dams do, had begun to leak. The dam had been up for 2 years at that point. And Tony Harnischweger, who was the dam keeper, called downtown and said, geez, there's another leak, but this seems to have mud in the water. And that would be dangerous. That would indicate that the foundation of the dam could be failing. So Mulholland went out with Harvey Van Norman, took a look, and didn't see any mud in the water. He saw mud later on as the water flowed through a construction, bunch of soil in construction, and left that day, that afternoon, assuring everyone that the dam was fine. The dam failed just shortly before midnight that same day.
Take us through the events from midnight on and the path of the flood. Briefly give us an overview of what happened.
It was horrendous. It happened just before midnight. One of the last people to pass by the dam site was a guy named Ace Hopewell, who was a carpenter, and he was riding a motorcycle back to his home in Powerhouse One, which is above the dam. And as he passed, he stopped to have a cigarette. And when he paused, he heard this rumbling sound, and he thought it was thunder, didn't know what it was exactly. And then he just sort of finished his cigarette and left. Well, that rumbling sound was the collapse of the dam. And the first time people knew was the people in the power plant above the dam. Suddenly, everything went, you know, gone. Power was gone. But the people below the dam, many were asleep. And all they heard was this incredible roar. They didn't know what it was at first. Some guessed right away, maybe the dam. They stepped outside their houses and faced a 140-foot tall wall of water. That mud, rock, and debris, not just water, that picked them up and threw them away. And below the dam site, there were only three survivors of 67 people who lived around the Powerhouse 2. Powerhouse 2 was built of concrete walls, huge, wiped off the canyon floor. And the dam roared west toward the Pacific Ocean and headed towards the Santa Clara River Valley, where there were a number of these agricultural towns. And it went 54 miles to the Pacific Ocean. Took 5.5 hours to get there. The dam and the reservoir itself emptied in less than an hour.
And it actually took bodies all the way into the ocean, didn't it?
Some bodies into the ocean, and many were one of the reasons why the death count is uncertain. It left a thick layer of silt, sometimes 8-10 feet of silt. And who knows what's underneath that.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with John Wilkman about his book, Flood Path: The Story of the St. Francis Dam Disaster. You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. You're listening to Blue Dot on North State Public Radio. We're talking to filmmaker and writer John Wilkman. He's the author of Flood Path, the story of the St. Francis Dam disaster that killed hundreds of people in Southern California in 1928. One of the fascinating parts of the book is the stories of survival. Could you share maybe one of those from us?
Well, we interviewed a survivor, Thelma McCauley Shaw, who was 13 years old, and she was living with her family in a little town called Bardsdale, and suddenly her house began to shake and vibrate, and her parents got up, and water was beginning to happen. The flood came in kind of, you know, waves, the first kind of a pre-flood, and then it hit in series, and then finally it arrived in its full. So her parents said, get her brother, get dressed, we have to leave. And they didn't know what really to do. And she said, I'm going to get out the back door. And her mother said, oh, you foolish child, you can't do that. She got out the back door and was immediately swept away by the flood. She woke up almost 20 miles downstream in a tree, totally stripped of her bedclothes. And she said, I woke up with the sun in my face. And it was like I woke up from a nightmare. And she never saw her parents again.
Wow.
Another survivor group was a very large workers that were working with Southern California Edison on a construction site. And they were in tents along the river, the Santa Clara River. And again, without any warning, suddenly this flood came. And those who were in the tents had buttoned up their tents. They floated like balloons because the air was in the balloon. But after a while, the water began to seep in, and the men desperately had to get out of those tents. And one man describes trying to rip open the canvas with his teeth and pulling his teeth out in the process until they find a nail and a piece of wood and rip a hole in the canvas and escape into an enormous whirlpool and spun around and around until some of them are drowned and others are just tossed up on the shoreline. And 143 men were in that camp. Most of them died that night, again, without any warning.
Let's talk about the immediate aftermath. What was the preliminary investigations, and what did they find out, and what did they not find out?
You have to put the St. Francis Dam in its historical context. Another dam was being constructed in the Colorado River, which is today's Hoover Dam. And the political times were not so dissimilar from now. The conservatives, the Republicans, did not want the government involved in utilities and those kinds of things, thought it should be done by private enterprise. The president and many other, the Democrats and others, believed that this is the way the country should grow with these enormous infrastructure projects. So the last thing anyone had wanted to know is, this dam collapsed, built by a government agency, the city of Los Angeles, just proving that governments cannot build these dams safely. So the investigation, frankly, because everybody in the engineering community and everybody knew that this, the entire West and the South would be transformed by new dams. So they rushed to get the answers out. And one of the reasons why it's not so well known is that nobody wanted to perpetuate this story, because it was a mistake. And ahead was probably the greatest period of dam building and the greatest period of the growth of the American West. So the engineer researchers came, and the official study by the state of California took 6 days. And they got the report out. They came to their conclusions. And even to this day, most people, when they refer to the conclusions about what happened, they go to the California Governor's Commission. And in fact, it's wrong.
And what did they conclude briefly?
Well, they went for the most obvious thing. When you look at the site, you see there's this schist, this hard layered rock on one side, and this conglomerate, which is a softer kind of rock on the other side. And their conclusion was on the west side, and the schist is on the east side. They concluded that, this soft rock just got saturated and failed. And that's what it was, and that brought down that side of the dam, and then the other side followed, and that's what happened. Later researchers came to the conclusion that no, and that's part of the fun of the book, and I don't want to give too much away, but it's a detective story. It's a technological detective story. They have clues. They follow clues, and they come up with, in the end, a different, which is really pretty much the explanation of today. They come up with a different explanation, which really involves the east abutment, the other side, and how that failed. And how they came to that conclusion is sort of fun. And I think readers might enjoy that because they're piecing together evidence. Sometimes that what they could do, because the dam was built with a stair step on the downstream side, they could find fragments of the dam downstream and place those fragments back into what the dam was. In other words, a drawing of the dam. They could say this piece came from this part of the dam. And they can actually construct what pieces came first and how they fell and what pieces on top of another piece. And they could really reconstruct a sense of how the failure happened in time. And that's what they did.
And, of course, we've been recently dealing with the structural failure of parts of the Oroville Dam spillway, which necessitated the evacuation of nearly 200,000 people. They're now back in that flood path, and things have stabilized. What was your reaction when you saw this unfold, and what lessons do you think we could learn from what happened back in 1928?
Well, I think the obvious lesson, which we often forget, is that a dam that holds back an enormous amount of water is like an enormous bomb waiting to go off. The destructive power of that kind of water being released is horrendous. And so that's really what the frightening images that came out of Oroville, would see the power of the water just escaping. And then what was it doing, not only to the designed concrete spillway, but for the alternative spillway? Just so how destructive the force it was. And also connected to that is that you can build, most engineers, they build to two or four times with more strength, factor of safety is what they call it, than normal, and sometimes even more than that. But there's often these extraordinary events, and this was an extraordinary event, this enormous, you know, after a drought, this incredible amount of water. And so it's really important that a couple of things. One, that the design takes in alternate ways of defending against an assault by nature, and also even more so the importance of maintenance. There are more than 4,000 dams in the United States today that the Society of Civil Engineers have declared they are in danger of failing. Now, not all of them are huge, like Oroville or even St. Francis, but it's not because they were poorly built; it's because they're not maintained. These dams are old. Many of them, the average dam in the United States is more than 50 years old. That's a long time to hold back tons of water. So the lesson really from Oroville and others is that we need to have this redundancy in there. It's really important. And also we need to really maintain and keep a watch on our dams. And the great era of dam building ended in the United States in the 1970s. It's going crazy and wild in India and China. But right now, there's a dam in Mosul, Iraq, built in the 1950s. War is going on to take back, you know, from ISIS. And that dam has not been maintained for a long, long time. And there are estimates, if that dam failed, 500 to a million people could die.
Wow.
And there are dams in China that have failed with similar numbers, 250,000 people dying.
I'd like to go back to the character of William Mulholland. He's been one of controversy for many years. He's vilified for L.A. taking water away from the Owens Valley and, of course, the tragedy of the St. Francis Dam. You open the story with the prologue where you met his granddaughter, Catherine. I'd like you to tell us briefly about that, and then what kind of conclusions have you drawn about the chief engineer through the story that you've told?
Well, I had known Catherine, and I talk about in the prologue of interviewing her and about her grandfather. She had written a biography, a very good biography of her grandfather. Of course, the chapter that was most difficult for her was the one on the St. Francis Dam, and she saw him as a Shakespearean Greek figure of Greek tragedy, who had risen high and fallen hard, an example of hubris. And that's really the character of Mulholland. His self-confidence, his ability to deliver, gave him a sense that he really did know better. And ironically, in many cases, he did. But it also was that, and the lessons of the St. Francis were among the engineering community, is that at that time, legally, any city that had its own engineering department could build the dam any way they wanted, without consultation, without the state being involved in any way. And Mulholland built what he wanted. and the Hetch Hetchy Dam in San Francisco, built the same way by O'Shaughnessy, the engineer and other Irishman in San Francisco. And Mulholland didn't feel he needed to consult anybody. And he built it the way he wanted to build it. And he was the man who built the aqueduct. And everyone laughed at that. It was by far the longest aqueduct ever built. And it's still working and it's still functioning. And people thought he couldn't do it. And he did. So his hubris must have been doubly painful in the case of the St. Francis, because everything his critics had said about him, that he really was arrogant and he didn't keep up with the latest technology and all of that, and his training wasn't adequate. He was self-trained. He wasn't, you know, an educated, university-educated engineer. All looked like it was true. And to him, it must have been devastating. It was devastating. He died 1935. He'd had a stroke before that. And as I say in the book, with a certain amount of, I think, genuine drama, he died basically because of the stroke, that he couldn't eat, but also he essentially died because he couldn't drink. He died from thirst. So it's almost an enormous figure you'd find in Shakespeare, or you'd find in a Greek tragedy. The results of St. Francis is that kind of man could never single-handedly build a dam ever again, and never did. The safety concern, the safety policies established by California became the national standard, and still are. But that doesn't mean, and one of the things I try to say, and somewhat in Mulholland's favor, is today, you know, engineers, oh, well, we've got computers and we're all educated at MIT, and we would never make a mistake of an old man who taught himself. You know, well, they do. Dam failed. The Teton Dam failed. Modern dam. Very similar circumstances, not a good foundation. A dam in France failed. Very similar circumstances, bad foundation. A dam in Italy failed. Killed many people. Very similar circumstances. So it really is a reminder, the Oroville's part of that, is the arrogance of feeling, well, we all know better than the old days. Well, we don't. Vigilance is important. Redundancy is important. Maintenance is important. No matter how many computers we have, that doesn't mean we can't run into a difficulty.
Well, John, we're out of time, but that was fascinating. And thank you for sharing your interest in the St. Francis Dam disaster with us.
And thank you for your interest in the book. And I appreciate, and I hope people have a chance to get the book, which is called Flood Path, The Deadliest Man-Made Disaster of the 20th Century in America and the Making of Modern Los Angeles.
We've been talking to John Wilkman. His 2016 book, Flood Path, published by Bloomsbury Press, tells the story of the failure of the St. Francis Dam north of Los Angeles in 1928 and the tragic loss of hundreds of lives that followed. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio. Listen to this as well as past episodes at mynspr.org, as well as iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at NSPR News or me at Dave Shlom. For Nolan Ford, who keeps his jeans hiked up in the control room just in case, we remind you that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.